The Writer Files, a member of the Podglomerate Network.
I wanted to combine these two kind of disparate ideas of acceptance and revenge and sort of meld them together, you know, through my own prism of my style and what I like to write about and the way I like to write. I think I've been accused more than once of being in love with similes, and I accept that accusation wholeheartedly. And so it became more than I intended, but not so much that I hope is not heavy-handed, because at the end of the day, it's still a book, it's still entertainment, it's still a story. And I say this often, nobody wants a 300-page sermon, but you can still take a little bit of honey in and help the medicine go down.
Greetings, scribes, and welcome back to The Writer Files. I am still your humble host, Kelton Reed, wishing you pages, patience, and prosperity per usual. Recent New York Times bestseller and award-winning neo-noir novelist S.A. Cosby returned to chat about his creative process, cinematic heroes, and fantasy casting his new revenge tale, Razorblade Tears. S.A. is also an Anthony Award-winning short story writer for Best Short Story 2019, and his short fiction has appeared in numerous anthologies and magazines. His lauded best-selling novel Blacktop Wasteland was Amazon's number one mystery and thriller of the year and number three best book overall for 2020, a New York Times Notable Book of the Year, New York Times Book Review Editor's Choice, winner of the LA Times Book Award for Mystery or Thrillers, and a Goodreads Choice Award semifinalist. His latest, Razorblade Tears, hits the New York Times bestseller list for the week of July 25th this year at number 10, and is described by ALA Booklist as a powerful blend of pulsing action, sensitive and subtle character interaction, and uncompromising but highly nuanced reflection on racism and homophobia. Number one New York Times bestselling author Michael Connelly said of the book, "Cuts right to the heart of the most important questions of our times. S.A. Cosby is not only the future of crime fiction, but of any fiction." In this file, S.A. and I discussed how he defines country noir, the genesis of the larger societal themes in his work, why he always starts with the problem and a stream of consciousness synopsis first, how finding his way into the plot is like finding his way into a locked house, the great American literary legacy of Odd Couples, and his hot take on Quentin Tarantino's directing. Stay calm and write on. And if you're a fan of The Writer Files, please click subscribe to automatically see new interviews as soon as they're published, and leave us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts to help other writers find us. Okay, we are rolling once again on The Writer Files, and I am privileged and honored today to be joined by a returning guest. I have the honorable best-selling neo-noir novelist S.A. Cosby. What's going on, man? How are you surviving over there these days?
Oh, man. Last couple days been crazy. The book has come out, and my latest, and it's been an incredibly gratifying and heartwarming outpouring of support, not just from my fellow writers, but from readers and people in the industry. It's just been an incredible moment. You know, if you told me 7 years ago when I decided to be a full-time writer that any of this would be happening, I would probably suggest you see a neurologist and have your head examined.
Yeah, it seems like it's been, you described it the last time we spoke as kind of an embarrassment of riches. So, you know, given the reception of Blacktop Wasteland, you know, going on to become a bestseller and hitting New York Times Notable, New York Times Book Review Editor's Choice, and then winning the LA Times Book Award. Congratulations on all of that. How are you feeling now? How are you feeling today?
I think even more embarrassed. I think, you know, I think if you're a writer or an artist and you start to become accustomed to accolades, I think you stagnate. I think, or as my mom would have said, you start believing your own hype. I think you stagnate as an artist. And so I am continuously, perpetually surprised and honored that people connect with my work. It makes the long hours and all the research and the questionable Google search histories worth it.
The questionable Google search histories. I like it. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time. It seems like you've almost outgrown the Writer Files in your renown, but thanks for taking the time. Yeah. So, you know, I think as a returning guest, I kind of want to, talk to you about obviously Razorblade Tears, which is the latest. And as of, you know, this recording, it will be out there in the world. And so you are on virtual tour right now, I take it. How does it feel now? Are you still doing kind of like a lot of hybrid stuff?
Oh, yeah. I think that's going to be not just for me, but I think going forward for the industry, I think the hybrid model is just going to be more cost efficient. That's not to say I don't like having in-person events, and I look forward to having in-person events. I actually had one yesterday at my favorite local bookstore, Chop Suey Books in Richmond, Virginia. We had a little event on the sidewalk, kind of in the open air, and people came by, stopped by and picked up some books, and some friends stopped by that I hadn't seen in like, 16 months. And I'm almost 100% fully vaxxed. I got my first dose. So, and everybody that I saw had already beaten me to the punch. So it was nice to actually have a little bit of human interaction again. It is different than with Blacktop, where Blacktop was almost, because, necessitated by the pandemic, was almost 100% virtual. I didn't do almost any in-store events. And even when I did one, but even then it was also at Chop Suey. You weren't able to get close to people. We had like a 6-foot social distancing barrier, and the books were like handed off to me by one of the employees at Chop Suey, who was wearing, surgical gloves, and it was just all very sterile. Yesterday was a lot different. We still taking precautions, but it just felt different. It just feels different. I think for me, I like interacting with people. I'm a rare writer, I think, where I'm an extrovert and I love talking to people. And so the opportunity to actually talk to people in person was just invigorating. I had one lady whose husband is a big fan and he couldn't be there. So she put him on FaceTime. So even that was really interesting. So it's just, again, as a writer, it is incredibly moving for me that people actually take the time out of their day to stop by. So that was awesome.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy. It's pretty great to see the reception that Razorblade Tears has received. I mean, in comparison to Blacktop Wasteland, it's just incredible. I thought that this Michael Connelly blurb was pretty great. He said, S.A. Cosby is not only the future of crime fiction, but of any fiction where the words are strong, the characters are strong, and the story has a resonance that cuts right to the heart of most important questions of our time. So let's kind of go to the origins of Razorblade Tears, because, last time we talked quite a bit about kind of your neo-noir origins and kind of this cinematic amalgamation that you put together. And you described it as kind of Defiant Ones meets Rolling Thunder, right?
Yeah. That's a pretty apt description, I think. As far as like my influences and where it came from, there's a couple of different pieces to the foundation there. One, I love cinema. I love the French New Wave, but I also love, like avant-garde cinema. But I'm also an unabashed fan of the grindhouse B-movie cinema, especially the mid to late 70s. And Razorblade Tears started out in my head as sort of an homage to those, tough, country noir movies that came out in that time period. It seemed like, in the late 70s, filmmakers discovered that there was like, 25 or 30 more states other than California and New York. And so they started filming movies in Louisiana and Florida and Georgia and North Carolina, South Carolina, and so on and so forth. And so movies like, The Defiant Ones or Rolling Thunder, which is one of my, anybody listening, Rolling Thunder is one of the great revenge movies of all time. It's also Tommy Lee Jones's first, I think his first film role with William Devane in that movie. That's how it started. I kind of had this image of this, sepia toned B movie in my head about two fathers seeking justice, seeking revenge. But what happened was it actually grew from that and became a little bit more than that. I had a friend who came out to his parents rather late in life, and it didn't go well. It wasn't pleasant, and they weren't very accepting of him. And so as we talked, it's sort of that's that idea or what he was going through seeped into my mind and seeped its way into the story. And so I came up with an idea. I wanted to combine these two kind of disparate ideas of acceptance and revenge and sort of meld them together, through my own prism of my style and what I like to write about and the way I like to write. I think I've been accused more than once of being in love with similes, and I accept that accusation wholeheartedly. And so it became more than I intended, but not so much that I hope it's not heavy handed, because at the end of the day, it's still a book. It's still entertainment. It's still a story. And I say this often, nobody wants a 300 page sermon, but you can still take a little bit of honey and help the medicine go down.
That's right. That's right. I think, can't we credit your mom with that?
I found out that she got that from Mary Poppins, but she used to say it all the time, and it still has a lot of resonance with me. I believe that. I think that's what the best books do, The best books entertain, but they also make you think, and they make you think in a way that's not, obtuse or too condescending, and that's always the high bar that I'm trying to reach.
Yeah. Well, congrats on the work and the reception. We won't do any spoilers here, but I thought kind of how BookPage described it was very apt. And, they just kind of described it as a mission-driven novel where, you're deconstructing the cultural plague of homophobia, both in larger society and in the Black community. And obviously this Southern noir is a very cinematic backdrop for that, in the way that you describe it or the way that you write it. But I don't know. I want to talk maybe a little bit more about your writing process, kind of.
Okay.
When you come to the screen or the page, and you come with an idea like this one, and then it kind of grows into something different. Yeah. How are you finding, or what are you finding is your most productive process from Genesis to kind of?
Yeah. For me, it always starts with what I like to call the problem, what is the problem that a character of mine is facing? And I like to sort of figure out the problem and the solution, and then I tell a story around it. And so for me, for instance, Raised Really 2 Years, the problem is, these two fathers and their sons have been murdered. And what does that mean? What does that look like? What does that entail for them? How does that affect them both, emotionally, spiritually, psychologically? Where do they go? What do they do? And so what I do for myself is I sit down and I write myself a very stream of consciousness synopsis. It's very much a Finnegan's Wake, but just for me. Nobody else ever has to suffer through it. And and so it's me telling myself the story. And like I said, it's very stream of consciousness. I just sit down and I start typing. I open up a Google Doc and I'll title it. And then I'll start telling myself the story. These two fathers, their sons are murdered. They're both ex-cons. They're men of violence. They've killed people. They've murdered people. They've done their time, and now they're members of society. And are they willing to, and so I tell myself the story that they're willing to risk their lives, their freedom to avenge their sons. And then I just tell myself a story beat by beat by beat. And then once I finish the synopsis, which a lot of times is very different from what the book actually looks like. But once I finish the synopsis, then I can start the book, because I can't start a book until I can tell myself the story. I can't tell you the story until I can entertain myself. Then once I can entertain myself, I can tell someone else's story. A lot of times for me, a book, finding a way into a book is like finding my way into a locked house, and I've misplaced my keys. And so I have to figure out a way to get in the story. And just for me, it's the synopsis. It's this little synopsis that, like I said, never sees the light of day. For a lot of other people, it's a different process. It's some people are total pantsers. Some people are outliners. I try to avoid outlining because I hate it. But at the same time, I'm not a complete 100% pantser, because I do like to have some structure to see where the story goes. But yeah, it all starts with me telling myself the story.
Yeah, you've obviously have a vast array of influences, and you know, kind of going back to this great legacy of American letters, especially, and you've talked about kind of turning some of these tropes on their head. You know, I wanted to ask about the relationship between Ike and Buddy, and this kind of odd couple teaming. You know, they're not that different, but there is this great legacy of, you know, from 48 Hours to Lethal Weapon, you know, teaming up.
Yeah,
the crazy white guy who has a drug problem with the really methodical African American, you know. Talk about
that. You take a story like Lethal Weapon. Take a story like Lethal Weapon, where Danny Glover, Roger Murtaugh is his character. Is, you know, he's close to retirement, and he's, you know, he's too old for this as he says. And then you've got, you know, Martin Riggs, who's this broken man, this damaged, crazy person, but with an incredible skill set. And what I always saw from movies like you were talking about 48 Hours or whatever, or Lethal Weapon or what have you. For me, as an African American writer, a lot of times those movies had an imbalance of power. And what I mean is, not that, say for instance, Lethal Weapon, not that Martin Riggs is more powerful than Roger Murtaugh, but because of his characterization, he's more interesting. You know, Roger plays a straight man to Martin's wild character. That imbalance is a little bit reversed in 48 Hours, but then thematically, Nick Nolte's character has the power over Eddie Murphy's Reggie Valentine, because he's the cop and Reggie's the criminal. And so for me, when I start down to write Reasonably Tears, I wanted to equalize that power. I wanted to remove that imbalance. I didn't want Ike to be more interesting than Buddy Lee, and I didn't want Buddy Lee to be more interesting than Ike. I really wanted them to be equals, because, like you said, they are more alike than they either one of them would care to admit. And Ike and Buddy Lee are really, you know, I'll say I did this intentionally, but not with intent. They're a microcosm of the South. You know, a lot of times I have more in common sometimes with a white man or a white woman from the South than I do with someone from any other part of the country. I can go to any person in my hometown, anybody in North Carolina, South Carolina, anywhere throughout the Bible Belt, and I can ask them what is Scrapple. I can ask them what are Hog Maws. I can ask them, what did your church do for homecoming? And I don't have to explain it, because there's this shared, this understanding, this cultural relevance that is specific and germane to the South. And so a lot of times those same individuals don't want to see that. They don't want to acknowledge the sameness, the compatibility, so to speak, that they share with members of the Black community. And so I wanted to take two characters that are from the same area, from the same town, whose sons are married and they still have never really crossed paths, and force them, literally put them in a truck in a sealed room and make them talk. And, you know, using the impetus of the fact that they're on a revenge mission, that also forces them to confront their prejudices about each other, their misunderstandings. And so again, it was interesting to take that trope of the, you know, the odd couple, the, you know, the guys, they just can't get along. Are they ever going to be able to put their interests aside, and kind of deconstruct it a little bit and flip it on its head?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, you talked about Grindhouse and that genre, and I couldn't help but compare, you know, your dialogue with some of Quentin Tarantino's dialogue. And It's interesting to me because he uses that trope quite a bit. He uses the odd couple trope, and I would think of obviously Pulp Fiction, but then you see it in, you know, even Jackie Brown and up through Django, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where you've got that, as you talk about that balance of power, but then it gets almost mitigated or balanced out by a dialogue that becomes very human, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Quentin, I think, here's a scorching hot take for you. I'm still a huge fan of his dialogue and his writing, but I think as I've re-experienced his work as an adult, I think the difference between Quentin and some other folks who are doing similar work or using that similar trope is that Quentin likes the iconography of the trope. He likes the visual of it. He likes the actual visual, mm-hmm. black guy to white guy. The, you know, this odd couple, can they get along? He likes the cultural, pop culture zeitgeist of the dialogue, as opposed to really investigating the characters. Because a lot of times, and that's just my opinion, a lot of times his direction invalidates the autonomy of the characters he's created. Like, for instance, everybody loves, I'm included, love Samuel Jackson's final speech in Pulp Fiction, where he's got the gun on Tim Roth and he's saying, you know, he says that great line, you know, the truth is you're the weak and I'm the tyranny of evil men, but I'm trying, Ringo, I'm trying real hard to be the shepherd. And then you juxtapose this walking, talking personification of badassery with this person who has a shuck and jive for Jimmy, his buddy, and who talks about his coffee. And so I think for me, as I've re-experienced these movies as an adult, I still love the dialogue. I still think he's one of the great writers of dialogue in film history. But I wonder sometimes, does he, and in that, negate, like I said, the autonomy and the authenticity of his characters by his direction. That's just my opinion, you know. I think the idea that you mentioned is dialogue can be so visceral. You know, conversations can be violent. Discussions can be physical almost. And I love creating dialogue that gives the reader that feeling. I love having conversations in my work where characters are cutting each other off like a real conversation. Where, you know, I can be accused of using dash marks too much, but I'm really trying to replicate how a real conversation sounds. That being said, yeah, I intentionally give my characters monologues sometimes. I intentionally have them, step out into the center of the stage to give a soliloquy, to quote, to use a Shakespearean term, because that's part of writing too. I'm a firm believer that a book doesn't have to be 100% realistic. Real life is real enough. When I go to a book, I want the personification of reality. I want an impression of reality. But if I wanted to, you know, have an actual conversation with somebody, I would go and talk to somebody for an hour. When I go into a book, I want mm-hmm. the characters to create a new type of environment for me to experience this story. And so, yeah, there are times when my characters will step, you know, like metaphorically step off the side of the stage and say something that I'm trying to say or I want them to say. And I think, again, dialogue-driven stories can do that in a way that I think other types of medium or stories can't. And so in that respect, I definitely admire like writers like Quentin Tarantino. David Mamet is another one that does that to an incredible extent. Mm-hmm. That the dialogue, the verbal jousting becomes almost as intimidating as a punch to the face. And I'm definitely trying to reach that level, trying to create that sense of, you know, a rhetorical combat, so to speak, in my writing.
Yeah, yeah. I just thought for one quick second to diverge to stage stuff. Did you ever see True West?
Oh, yeah, I love True West. Sam Shepard.
Yeah.
I love True West.
Yeah. I thought of that because I do love Mammoth also. And then I thought from stage to page, that's pretty interesting stuff. I could pick your brain more about it. I do want to mention, I know you got to go, Razorblade Tears, S.A. Cosby's latest, we'll link to in the show notes, a provocative, fast-paced story of bloody retribution, heartfelt change, maybe even redemption. And I thought Washington Post had a very nice blurb. They said, say Cosby's new crime novel is provocative, violent, beautiful, and moving too. And Elmore Leonard, wherever you are, you've got competition.
I read that and I had to sit down. I mean, you know, there are three people,
right?
There are three writers for me personally that are on the Mount Rushmore of crime writing. Elmore Leonard, Walter Mosley, and Dennis Lehane. When you talk about dialogue, when you talk about characters, when you talk about motivation, when you talk about plot, those are the high bars for me. Those are the vaunted elders. And, you know, two of them have given me blurs for a book. And one of them is unfortunately no longer with us. So to get a blur from Dennis Lehane, to get a blur from Walter Mosley, and then have someone compare me to Elmore Leonard, it's the trifecta of what I thought I wanted to achieve as a writer. You know, it doesn't get any better than that.
Stunning work. Thank you very much for taking the time. Before we sign off here, you're on Twitter, you're on Facebook. I'll link to all those things.
Yep.
Any news on film or small screen adaptations of your work?
Yeah, real quick. Both Blacktop Wasteland and Razorblade Tears have been optioned for film. The script, or a working script for Blacktop Wasteland, has been completed by the great Virgil Williams, the co-writer of Mudbound, which was an Oscar-nominated film a couple years ago on Netflix. The script for Razorblade Tears is being written as we speak. And like everyone else, I fantasy cast it in my head when I was writing it. I don't know if those are the people that will end up in a possible film, but inspirations for both Buddy Lee and Ike were Buddy Lee was inspired by the great Sam Elliott. I actually make reference to that a couple times in the book. And Ike was inspired by the great, great underrated actor, Delroy Lindo, just was most recently seen in The Five Bloods. So those are who I was envisioning. Everybody else can envision whoever they want. I've heard all kinds of names bandied about, and I don't disagree with any of them. They all sound like wonderful choices. So,
oh man, that's good casting. I can see both iconic actors now in those parts, and now I won't be able to unsee that as I
I'm sorry
as I read more of the book. But hey, congrats. Please come back and talk with us again. Do have safe journeys, and be they virtual or otherwise, enjoy the rest of your book tour, my friend.
Thank you so much for having me back, man. I would love to come back again. It's been such a blast.
Thanks so much for joining us for this episode of The Writer Files. And if you enjoy the podcast, please subscribe to the show and leave us a rating or a review to help other writers out there find us. You can always leave a comment or a question and visit the entire archives at writerfiles.fm. And you can chat with me on Twitter at Kelton Reed. Cheers. Talk to you next week.